Chapter 2. The scene in Droon's tent was not, Tony could tell, what McLaren and the others must have pictured. The colonel's bodyguard looked particularly nonplussed to find himself seated, without rifle, which had been taken from him as he entered the tent, not in a bare-bones affair, filled only with guns or some dingy, decadent, curtained inner chamber, thick with aggravatingly sweet hookah smoke and the scent of menace, but cross-legged on rugs in a sumptuously arranged tent, seated across from no menacing, slimy, mustache twirler straight from a Hollywood movie, who could only bark demands in broken English, but opposite from a handsome, lean man, whose easy smile, relaxed posture, and excellent command of a language not his own, suggested he legitimately enjoyed the chance to communicate and negotiate with people, if not exactly for the reasons they might have wanted. Similarly, the decor implied Droon had an appreciation as much for art and culture as he did for his enterprise as a leader. The rug they now sat on was no cheap mass-produced thing from some American warehouse, but a beautifully woven piece, as artful and striking as the paintings that stood around the tent on various easels.
"Believe it or not, the life of a warlord is full of downtime, Colonel," Droon had joked as he led the group in. "Downtime in which I find it comforting to practice my craft. A leader must lead in all things. Wouldn't you agree?"
For that, McLaren had no answer. Not, as Rasteen warned, that he truly cared to hear what the colonel, or any of the unit here, had to say. Just that he found there something sporting in the act of negotiation that kept him from getting bored.
"I must say, friends, that you do know how to make an entrance. But then, that kind of flashy performance, that's what I've come to expect from Americans after all these years. A little shock, a little awe, isn't it?"
That was an earlier administration's way of doing things. And 15 years later, I'd like to think we're past that. I prefer a more subdued tact, personally. Tony turned his gaze to Rasteen, who returned his look with a dispassionate stare that suggested if Tony really did want this negotiation to be a success, he should not get too comfortable. Droon smiled at this, but not without a small bit of irony.
"Yes, Rasteen tells me you have a reputation for always finding the best possible solution for every party involved. But I wonder, Mr. Rodriguez, what the best possible solution means to you, and what it means to me and my community."
Tony was only just opening his mouth as McLaren's voice grumbled to life. Before he could even think to react, Rasteen shot him a look that suggested he had better collar the man, and soon. Droon might be charismatic and friendly, but he was hardly one to tolerate brazen insult after such a generous display as inviting strangers into his house.
"It means that you'll finally have state-of-the-art water infrastructure. If you just let us expand the scope of our project to include your land and the land of your tribe, we could bring water to the whole..."
"Excuse me, Colonel, but the question was addressed to me." Tony followed up his declaration with a stony glare that suggested he was absolutely done playing around, that he was content to be written up to his superiors back at Northern Command if this is what it took to get the results he'd come to Afghanistan to take care of. He then turned to Droon, his face the picture of embarrassment. "My apologies, sir. But what Colonel McLaren would like to suggest is that while this isn't an entirely altruistic endeavor, he does want you to understand that it's also not an unfavorable promise. While we stand to gain plenty from it, you would enjoy as much, if not more, of a boost." So saying, he bowed low.
"As it should be. Who but a fool would come looking to strike a bargain that only costs him money? And who but a fool would accept a promise he himself can see no gain in?"
Droon less asked than said, as a new, more impish grin replaced the old one on his face.
"And I do not think that my good friend Ristin would waste my time bringing fools into my house."
Tony nodded. "As you say, while there's no doubt that the army's plans to reroute the waters of the Argandab for a reservoir will be a major benefit to our own supply lines and the comfort of our soldiers and bases in the region, it is also true that the improvements we plan to make to the water storage and distribution infrastructure in the region represent a boon to you as much as they do to us. If you've had time to read our report, you might see that not only has the governance of Kandahar City approved this plan, but that the vast majority of tribal leadership in the area has similarly seen the benefits this might provide, too." The entire time Tony had been talking, he'd also been studying Droon's face to see if any of his words roused suspicion, annoyance, frustration, or, out the outside, any kind of pleasure. But the mask of his knowing smile betrayed nothing of any deeper sentiments. He simply nodded to indicate his attention every few seconds. Even now, as he began to speak, his features stayed as inscrutable as ever. He hated to admit it, but Tony found something pleasurable in the prospect that Droon was treating this like play. Sometimes Tony, too, relished a bit of gamesmanship in his negotiations.
"Indeed, I have reviewed your proposal. You would not be here if I had found it, let us say, less than convincing. It's a particularly American specialty, this ability to sell anything well. And indeed, I have been in consultation with other leaders in the area, all of whom speak highly of the benefits this little project would bring. A reliable flow of water, systems of filtration and purification to ensure it remains renewable for years, and deliberate rationing that guarantees protection from unexpected drought and ensures the soil remains strong and well-fertilized, with no clause hidden in there to allow one more colonizer to set up a poppy field."
"Those are the broad strokes," Tony offered, aware that Droon was not done talking, but eager to assure him he was listening. Droon, for his part, continued on as if he had not heard Tony, his voice gaining an edge to it as he went on.
"And all I have to do is let your armed friends dig thousands of miles of pipelines through the lands of me and my countrymen. Is that it? Let you occupy our farms with your armed men, your tanks and your trucks for months at a time before handing oversight of our literal life water to you?"
"Yes, indeed. But listening to it, it seems like too good a deal to pass up. Wouldn't you agree?" he said, with the smallest vocal flourish, as he turned to his bodyguards, associates, and lieutenants, all of whom seemed less than moved by the offer on display. The anger in his phrasing was unmistakable, but Tony was impressed to see how little frustration Droon betrayed in his voice, or his face, or any of his body language. Tony knew that he risked alienating the man if he insisted on the efficacy of the plan, or emphasized its efficiency at the expense of his people and their pride, and so decided it'd be better to appeal to his host's sense of civic responsibility.
"I'm sorry if there must have been some miscommunication, but centralized control of the reservoir and the waters connected to it would never be in the hands of the American military, in any way. That responsibility would begin and remain with the governing body of the city of Kandahar, which would, in turn, be answerable to the leadership of the surrounding tribes. The contract we've drawn up ensures that the final decision would come down to local leadership, not to Americans."
"And if they decided that they might just as well ignore the voices of smaller tribes to placate those who hold greater power,
Or worse, that they were no longer interested in our words or found generating consensus too difficult for their liking. You may not realize this, Mr. Rodriguez, but me and my associates make up only a very small voice within this community. What is life or death to us is paperwork to some of these people. If it was decided that bigger concerns outweighed our own, then we could simply be swept aside with no challenge. Which does make me curious. Why is it you want our cooperation so badly? Would it not be easier to lie to us, give us everything you want, and then leave it to the pencil pushers back home to break these promises? What is to keep you from sweeping us aside the moment we become inconvenient? I appreciate your taking the time to meet with us and consider us in your plan. Truly, I do. But you must understand, if I think we are being played, when the part we play in this is so small and yet so much energy is spent winning us over.
Tony could tell by the lilt of his voice that Droon knew the answer to this question already, that he was setting up a conversational trap. If Tony fed him some lie about how America had been waiting to enact its plan for this reservoir until they had unanimous agreement as part of some larger effort to build community and trust by demonstrating a commitment to a new style of diplomacy, Droon would be done with him as much because he did not trust Tony's words as because he would be insulted by the laziness of Tony's response. On the other hand, Tony had to wonder if he was the kind of player who would respect the bold and forward approach of blatant honesty. Straightforward as he was also clever, and likely did not fall for those who resorted to earnest bluster to prove their goodwill. It was entirely possible that Tony's admission that they needed Droon's tribal contingent on board because the engineers needed that land to enact their current designs for the infrastructure. Without it, they would have to build a far more circuitous route that would cost tens of millions more and delay the project by years and years, would prove just as insulting as any rose-scented lie. More than that, though, he respected Droon too much to string him along or patronize him. For all his gamesmanship, he was a natural-born leader who was working towards the betterment of his people. His obstinate refusal might create roadblocks for other communities in the area, absolutely, sabotaging their own fortunes, but it sprung out of a deep investment in his immediate and found family. He had principles, even if they were more limited than Tony liked to see. As he mulled over his decision, he could feel McLaren's eyes on him, sizing him up to see what reckless action he'd take now, no doubt. He could feel as well Riker's annoyed look, concerned for the success of this negotiation. Cautious that his distraction not be noticed, he flicked his eyes over to Bastien to see if his friend might at least drop a smile or a nod that suggested the path he should choose, but the older man was looking at the ground, lost in conversational calculations Tony could only guess at. It was then, observing Rasheen as he gamed out his scenario, that Tony realized what he had to do. Droon was smart, yes, and studied, but he was also clearly a man who enjoyed a good competition. He was a gamesman first and foremost. It was that element Tony would have to appeal to convince him. In that case, he could tell him anything he wanted, so long as, at the end, it amused Droon and gave him the position of play he most valued. You're not wrong when you suggest that our interests in you, your people, and their land are not purely altruistic. McLaren bristled at these words, Tony could tell, even if he didn't see it for himself. Droon, as ever, stayed steady, inscrutable, though Tony could swear he saw a bit of warmth enter his smile finally. As it stands, our engineers have mapped out a plan that would chart the infrastructure connecting this reservoir to most of the Kandahar region directly through a number of your tribe's most prominent members' lands. Any change at all would cost us tens, if not hundreds of millions, and set our project back by years. As it stands, this plan lives and dies at your tribe's, and by extension, your decision. If you say no, then it's dead in the water. Pardon the pun. Ristin smirked at this, Droon as well, and with that, Tony could feel the atmosphere shifting. To further emphasize that, and to prove that he found Tony interesting, Droon uncrossed his legs, rose from where he sat, and ambled over to one of his easels, where he turned his back on Tony.
"You are pardoned, I have to say, Mr. Rodriguez, that I appreciate your openness. It's refreshing, for once, to negotiate with somebody who is not trying to sell me something with one hand and with the other picks my pocket while I'm distracted. Are you an art fan?"
Christine turned to face his friend with a look that suggested, for good or for bad, that he had unlocked something in Droon he would not be able to easily put back. To his right, McLaren bristled, and his bodyguard sneered, feeling acutely that they were being mocked, but Tony stayed them with his upraised hand. What they saw as an insult, Droon likely saw as a compliment, a sign that he was taking his guests seriously enough to treat them to a round of play. "I've dabbled here and there," Tony lied. "Though I prefer impressionism to the kind of realism you practice."
"That is a first, isn't it?" Droon said, with droll amusement. "I would have pictured that a nuts and bolts engineer like yourself would be too rigid to appreciate the challenges to perspective and perception that the impressionist masters offer up. Tell me, then, looking at my painting, do you think you can understand what I was attempting to convey based on mere representation alone?"